This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. There's something very beguiling about the idea of communication with another species. Clearly, animals possess a kind of intelligence and they're able to recognize and respond to words, but what are they thinking? What if you could ask them? What if they could answer? In the 1970s, a Columbia University psychology professor tried to answer those questions. He set up an experiment to raise a chimpanzee as a human and teach it sign language. But things didn't go exactly as planned. The story is the subject of a book, Nim Chimpsky, and a new documentary called Project Nim. My guests today played a part in that story and were interviewed for the film. So give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And if you're on Twitter, you can tweet us. We are questions by writing the @ followed by SciFry. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website, www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now, let me introduce my guests. Jenny Lee was 13 years old when the infant chimpanzee Nim moved into her house and became a part of the family. She's now a landscape architect, and she joins us from WUIS in Springfield. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Bob Ingersoll was a graduate student at the Oklahoma Institute for Primate Studies when Nim was transferred there. He's now the president of Mindy's Memory Primate Sanctuary in Oklahoma, and he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you having us on.
And also with us today is John Cohen. He's a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. Welcome back to Science Friday, John.
Pleasure to be here, Joe.
Great. So let's start with you, John. Tell us, what were the basics of Project Nim? What was this setting out to do?
In the 1970s, there were a lot of ape language research programs underway. Maybe, by a lot, I mean maybe on the order of a dozen, where people were trying to see if they could teach English in particular mostly through American Sign Language, but also with tokens and other ways of communicating to chimpanzees and bonobos eventually and gorillas. So Project Nim was Herbert Terrace's effort to see whether he could, by enculturating a chimp, having it live with humans, whether it could learn to communicate with language.
And had there been chimp studies? I mean, was this the first one where how long had people been doing this for?
Well, it dates back to the 1890s with a kind of crazy American who went and lived in the jungle in Gabon and tried to speak with chimpanzees, a guy named Richard Lynch Garner. And then there were serious scientific attempts in the 30s and 40s where couples in particular, husband and wife teams, took chimpanzees into their homes and tried to teach them to speak with vocalizations, but they don't have our apparatus. They couldn't do that. And also with sign language. And all of them had some success, but not that much. And everyone kind of hit the wall. Hmm. And in the 60s and 70s, people started to have more and more success.
Okay. Jenny Lee, you were 13. How did your family get involved in this?
My mother had been a student of Dr. Terrace's at Columbia, and she was approached by him when he became interested, I think, in doing a home study with a chimpanzee. And then quite unexpectedly, a chimp was born at the Primate Center in Oklahoma. They hadn't realized that the mother was pregnant, and suddenly the project was on. Mm-hmm. We were sort of informed as a family that we were getting a baby chimp. And needless to say, everyone was quite excited by that. My mother had remarried, and so we were a blended family of seven kids, spanning from about 8 to 15.
Wow.
So it was an exciting moment.
You know, I was walking down to the NPR studios in New York today, and I walked down Columbus Avenue past 78th Street, where I guess you were living in a brownstone, is that right?
That's correct.
I guess what I wanted to ask you is, okay, so you're 13 years old, and you go to school, and you tell your friends, hey, we just adopted a chimpanzee. And what was that like?
Well, there people were excited, and probably people didn't believe it.
Did they come over?
Really,
did
you... when can we come over? Yeah. When can we play with him? Bring him to school? All of those kind of 13-year-old questions were popping up, I think, amongst all of our all of the kids, all of our friends. And at the very beginning, like any newborn, you don't want to be bringing in a lot of germs and things into the home. So it was more limited. But as he grew up, I did bring him to school one day for a period and to show him off and sort of very fancy show and tell. And his time outside was limited in the neighborhood just for more particularly for health reasons. Mm-hmm. And then also it would create a little bit of a stir sometimes.
So Nim starts off in this apartment or this brownstone on West 78th Street. Then he moves up to a mansion, a sort of a mansion, a large house in Riverdale in the Bronx. And then he winds up back in Oklahoma. And Bob Ingersoll, that's when you get back involved with him or start to become involved with him?
Right. I met him in September of 1977 when Herb Terrace decided that the project was no longer feasible, at least no longer feasible with Nim there. And so they returned Nim to the Institute for Primate Studies where he was born, and that's where I met him.
Could you tell, from the first time you saw Nim, that this was an animal that had a different skill set than your, most chimpanzees?
Yeah, I actually did. I saw him signing with Bill Tynan and Joyce Butler, and his ability, at least in sign language, to me seemed phenomenal. At least as good as Washa, who I'd been working with for a number of years. So I was impressed. I was also impressed by just how freaked out he was, and just how freaked out Bill and Joyce looked. And there are a
freaked
number
out,
of factors.
Freaked out? Why?
Well, in the sense that he looked pretty traumatized. They both looked, reasonably traumatized by the whole, having to give him back. And he'd never been around other chimps before. So all those things were playing into the situation. But I was a student, so I just simply stood back and watched what was going on that day.
We're talking with Bob Ingersoll and Jenny Lee, both of whom were involved in Project Nim, although I guess it stopped being a project by the time Bob Ingersoll got involved and became more a life story. And also John Cohn, who's a science writer from Science Magazine and written a book called Almost Chimpanzees. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. And let's take a call now and go to Hal in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Hal, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's your question? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, since chimps seem to display emotion to their handlers and to their own kind, isn't that a form of language?
Bob Ingersoll, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a form of language. I think that a lot of our communication is in the nonverbal realm, and I think that that at least as far as I'm concerned, that counts as language. There's communication going on, and there's a message being passed back and forth. So I'd consider that at least a form of language or at least one of the tools that language uses to be able to be enriched and full like language is.
But how sophisticated? I mean, if you're expressing happiness or hunger or some primal emotion through face nonverbal communications or whatever, is that a substantive communication, or is that just sharing information?
That's definitely sharing information, but then when it's coupled with sign language in a system that we teach them, so not only is the nonverbal going on, but also the sign and the correct context and the correct signs to go along with it, that seems to me to be an added something that no other animal that I've ever seen can do. I mean, your dog can't do that. Your dog can make you, read all the cues that they give, but your dog can't use sign language coupled with it in order to get the point across. So I think it's slightly more sophisticated.
Hal, thanks for that. Yeah, go ahead, Jenny.
Jump in one second. One of the things that I observed Nim doing at a fairly young, I think he was three, was using the sign for bite, which was a way of he would express his anger instead of actually biting you. So he was learning to use these signs to express those primal feelings of I'm angry, I'm gonna pissed off at you, you've taken something away from me. And he would sign bite rather than coming charging over, and what he would do without using the signs would be to try to bite you as a way of making you do what he wanted you to do, just as any little kid or something might do.
Yeah. That's so. A perfect example of exactly what I'm speaking to. So,
John Cohen, I was just going to ask, is this language, language as a scientist or a psychologist might describe it?
You know, in the research community, there's a very strict sort of definition of what is language, and they separate language from communication. Those are two separate ideas, and Herbert Terrace's whole project was about language. It wasn't simply about sophisticated communication. We all know that chimpanzees are very smart and that they can communicate at very high levels. But is it language? That's the central question Terrace was addressing. And then how do you define language?
Well, what did Terrace conclude?
Well, Terrace concluded in a 1979 paper that was published in Science, and the question was, can an ape create a sentence? That was the name of the paper, and his conclusion was no, that what they had done with Nim was essentially fooled themselves into believing that Nim was speaking in sentences. But when they reviewed videotapes, and they also reviewed Washoe and Coco the gorilla, they saw that largely the apes were imitating what the researchers were trying to communicate, and that didn't qualify as language. You know, language is grammar. It's a large vocabulary. It's putting ideas inside of ideas called recursion, and children, human children, by the age of 3, are doing this very easily and naturally. And the critical point Terrace was making that upended the entire field was that no ape had done those things.
Okay, John, we have to interrupt you right there because we have to break away for a short break, but we'll come back. We're talking about Project Nim with some of the people who participated and some John Cohen, who's a science writer who's written a great deal about chimpanzees. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about the story of the chimpanzee Nim, who was raised as a human and taught to speak sign language. My guests are Jenny Lee, who grew up with Nim in her household, Bob Ingersoll, who worked with Nim as a graduate student, and they were both in the new documentary Project Nim. Also with us is John Cohen. He's the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Lab Sanctuaries and Zoos. And I'm sorry, John, I had to cut you off just before the break. Did you want to finish that thought about language?
Well, I think that an important point Terrace was making is that we have to be careful when we look at the dividing line between communication and language. Part of language requires listening, and one of the points Terrace made is that Nim wasn't very good at listening. It wasn't really interested in that level of communication of what we really consider to be language. And so when you look critically at what Nim was doing, I don't doubt for a moment what Bob and Jenny experienced, that Nim communicated at a very sophisticated level. Is that language? And I think the evidence that Terrace presented in 1979 was compelling that it was not language, and I think it stands till this day with every great ape that has been enculturated by humans and attempted to speak English, for the most part, with sign language.
All right, let's take another call now and go to Jane in Marin County. Jane, you're on Science Friday. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. This is fascinating. I love shows like this, and I love the topic. I'm looking at October 1978 National Geographic with Coco the gorilla on the front page. He's got a camera in his hands, and he's taking a picture. And I wonder if any of your guests are familiar with the woman who reared Coco. Hmm. And taught him sign language, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful story.
Let me ask, do any of you know about Coco at all?
Coco's actually a female, and yes, I do know about Coco.
Uh-huh.
Yes, she.
Yeah, Coco's actually a replication of the Washoe Project. So Coco was, I believe, was at the San Francisco Zoo and was worked with by Penny Patterson, who now lives here in the Bay Area with Coco and runs the, I believe it's called the Gorilla Foundation, and continues the work with Coco to this day.
Jane, thanks.
I've never met I've never met Coco or been around her, but
okay.
I have a friend who met Coco, who actually went down to Palo Alto when they were down there and met Coco and spent some time with her, and it was the most exciting thing that ever happened to my friend in her life.
I think that Coco and Neil Young have actually hung out together from what I've heard here recently.
Wow. Bob, maybe,
so back in the day.
Maybe you can pick up the Nim story, because he came back to Oklahoma when he was 5 years old, is that right?
Yeah, about five.
And what? How long did he live, and what were the later years of his life like?
Well, he was in Oklahoma after he returned for about 5 years, and then unfortunately the Institute was, fell on hard times financially, and the chimpanzees were sold to a laboratory in New York called the Laboratory for Experimental Medicine and Surgery in Primates. It's called LEMSIP. And fortunately for Nim, he was only there for a couple of weeks before he was removed and moved eventually to a place in Texas called the Black Beauty Ranch, where he lived for about a year and a half alone, and then about 85 or so, another chimpanzee named Sally was brought down to Black Beauty Ranch, and they lived together there for about 10 years until Sally died, about the time Sally died is when I came back into Nim's life and spent the next 5 years trying to help him out. We ended up getting a couple of other chimps from LEMSIP to move there and another chimp from the Colston Foundation, So he lived till he was 26, and he passed away at the Black Beauty Ranch.
Okay, let's take another call now and go to Tom in Baltimore. Tom, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air. Tom? Okay, that didn't work so well. How about, Peg? Peg in, that's Matt in Roanoke, Virginia. Matt, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I had a question for your psychologist guest. He was just talking about the animals not using human grammar, but it seems like we can't really expect them to. And to what extent an attempt had been made to use animal grammars or to figure out animal grammars. My dog, for instance, bows when she means play, and that's it seems only reasonable to kind of meet the animals halfway. So I'll take my answer off the
Okay, thanks, Matt. Well, I have to say I'm afraid we don't actually have a psychologist. Bob Ingersoll's an anthropologist, but John, I think that was the point you were making, and you've talked to psychologists, so maybe you can elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, the point that the caller is making is an excellent point. Why are we trying to teach these other species to speak the way we speak? And there have been studies of wild chimpanzees to look at how they communicate with each other to better understand their level of communication. It doesn't appear to be grammar. And grammar has a set of rules that we very early on internalize and learn. There's no strong, compelling evidence that I've ever seen of any species other than humans who live by that set of rules. That doesn't mean that animals in the wild don't communicate with things that even approach words to identify specific predators, let's say. But it's not language. It's not grammar.
Okay. Gary in St. Louis, Missouri, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was studying animal behavior right around this time and actually went down to Oklahoma and met with Washoe and got to play with Nim's brother, who was Onan, which one thing I'm just glad to hear. I hear that he was also spared from medical research. I'd like to know if he's still...
No, that's not true.
Yeah,
well, actually, I can tell you what happened.
During this time, I mean, these were people who really cared about these animals, and I found out more recently that Nim was taken away from his mother pretty much right after birth. That's got to be an awfully traumatic event to a mother chimp. And how did I realize your guys weren't involved in that decision, but how did the people, do you think, justify that traumatic of a thing just for this sort of a study?
Bob Ingersoll, I mean, you weren't there at the very initial phase of this, but what do you make of that idea of taking a baby chimp from its mother?
Well, bad idea, obviously, and traumatizing for the mother and the infant. And I can just jump in on Onan. Unfortunately, Onan did stay at LEMSIP for most of the time. LEMSIP was open, and then when in the film, it depicts Jim Mahoney, who is the lab veterinarian at LEMSIP. Actually, Jim and I worked together, and Onan was spared and didn't go into further medical research, and he was moved to a place in Texas called Primarily Primates at about the same time that we got a couple of NIM a couple of chimpanzee buddies. And so, unfortunately, Onan didn't get to see NIM again, but he did get out for a couple of years before he also passed away right around the age of 26. So I don't know. Maybe we actually met. I worked with Onan quite a lot, actually.
Generally, there's something I'm curious about. Now, you know, obviously you've seen this film and you know the story of what happened to NIM after you were involved. You didn't have any role, I'm sure, in deciding to get involved in this. But how do you feel about your involvement at this point?
It's something that I feel very conflicted about, in that the outcome for NIM, as there had really never been a plan. Something at 13 I was completely unaware of, but as NIM matured and one thing led to one thing, and he was taken from our home and taken to Riverdale and taken from there back to Oklahoma and then from Oklahoma to LEMSIP, he had become my brother emotionally, and then to be following his life and knowing that it was in some ways going downhill step by step, in terms of being further and further away from what he had known as an infant. Now, one thing that's been wonderful about the film and the book has been being able to meet and you know, sort of reunite with people that were involved in NIM's life. But it's left a very almost shameful – it's something I'm not proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Being involved with, and it's only since the publication of Elizabeth's book and Elizabeth Hess's book and James Marsh's movie that I've actually started talking about it, because it was traumatic, I think, for all of us, and in different ways, because you form such a tight bond with this creature.
You actually referred to him as a brother, and I wonder if you'd make the distinction. I mean, it's different somehow than a dog or some other animal that you might have had who was beloved by the family.
Exactly. Very, very different. A dog is, you know, I love dogs. I have a dog. And they know you. They request things. They ask to play. They ask to go out. But at heart, they're still a dog. They're still an animal that responds sort of instinctually to everything. And NIM was not. NIM was very tuned into the situation, the emotions of the situation. He would, if you were sad or crying or had a fight with my mother or something like that, and he would come and sit on your lap and give you a hug and kiss the little tears away. And in a way that was not the same as, you know, your dog worrying that something was wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the dog is thinking about the dog.
Yeah.
NIM seemed to be thinking about you. So you were able to form this really amazing bond.
Well, it certainly was a remarkable experience, and probably one that won't be repeated very often. But
hopefully
I'm afraid we've run out of time. So first let me thank you, Jenny Lee. She's a landscape architect based in, is it New York?
In New York,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Bob Ingersoll is the president of Mindy's Memory Primate Sanctuary in Oklahoma. They were both in the film Project NIM in theaters now. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my buddy NIM.
Okay. And John Cohen is a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Jeff.